It's called the Veda Motivation. Since we've been studying Shantideva's texts, engaging the Bodhisattva's deeds, hopefully we're developing some interest and aspiration to generate the bodhicitta within ourselves. And if we have regard and reverence for bodhicitta and want to generate it, then we want to eliminate obstacles to doing so and create conducive situations for doing so. So one of the biggest obstacles to generating bodhicitta is anger, and then attachment and apathy. So why are these obstacles to aspiring to become a Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings? To generate bodhicitta, we need first to have great compassion for living beings, a mind that wants them to be free of dukkha and its causes, and is willing to get involved in making that happen. Now, if we don't like some sentient beings, or we're mad at them, or we look at them and feel threatened, then having compassion for them is going to be difficult. Similarly, if we look at them with attachment, exaggerating their good qualities, projecting good qualities that aren't there, and having a mind that wants to get something from them. In other words, we're attached because they do something good for us. Then also that's going to interfere with having compassion, because we can't see those sentient beings accurately when there's attachment. And similarly with apathy, we don't even see living beings as living beings with feelings. So we don't really care. And, have no interest in their situation. And so, again, difficult to have compassion for them from our side. So as much as possible, we should try and overcome the attachment, anger, and apathy. And to see sentient beings as equal. Everybody wanting happiness, nobody wanting suffering, just like us. And on the basis of seeing them like that, then we can contemplate their dukkha and wish them to be free of it. and from that generate bodhicitta. So it seems rather natural for us afflicted beings to put people in categories according to how they relate to us. So we have friend, enemy, stranger, attachment, anger, apathy. And it seems if you talk to anybody in the street, it's like, yeah, of course, this is natural and it's good because we have to know who our enemies are so we can protect ourselves from them and know who our friends are so that we can stay close to them and know who strangers are so we can just navigate around them and not get, you know, stuck. And the idea of seeing all these people equally seems horrible to worldly people, because if there aren't people that I'm attached to, then I'm not going to feel close to anybody. Yeah, I only feel close to the people I'm attached to. So attachment is good. Otherwise, I'm going to feel alienated and cut off and or I'll just fall into dislike for everybody. Yeah? Well, that's the way we think as ordinary beings. But that's not the Buddhist perspective, okay? Because what the Buddha is suggesting we train our mind in is seeing every living being as having been kind to us. And when we see them having been kind to us in one way or another, then this thing of who can I get something, you know, who am I attached to because of those are the people who meet my needs, do what I like, the people who I can get something from. We lose interest in that because we see that all sentient beings have been kind to us. And similarly, you know, we realize people get in bad moods, they do harmful things, they're confused. Yeah, and so sometimes, you know, we don't get along with them, but that doesn't mean they're bad people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what the Buddha's teaching us here is really stretching our usual perspectives and ways of seeing things. And we hear it over and over and over again. Yeah, because we so easily go back into attachment, anger, and apathy. Yeah. And another element that keeps us stuck in attachment, anger, and apathy is how we categorize people based on very superficial things. Sometimes we haven't even spoken to them, but just on the way they look, we categorize them as person we can trust, person we can't trust, person we just block out. We haven't even talked to them. We don't even know them. Okay? And especially if you're a soldier, you know, you're fighting and trying to kill all these people who you've never even met. Yeah? And as Muhammad Ali said, you know, why am I trying to kill people who haven't done anything to harm me? When he was, you know, refusing to go into the army, and he was a conscientious objector. is absolutely right, you know? Like, these people haven't done anything to me. It's all, you know, what the leaders kind of do. Which is why I've always thought that the leaders should just get in a sandbox like three-year-olds and fight it out and then go away and let the rest of us live in peace. Anyway, but we form these identities with people based on, even if we know them, sometimes a short amount of time. Yeah, a very short amount of time. You know, some small thing happens, and then we just put them in the enemy box, and that's it. And they stay there forever and ever and ever. Yeah? And next time we see them, even though, yeah, we hardly know them, we see them as somebody to avoid. Yeah. I notice that sometimes if I'm in a group situation and with some people I know and some people I don't know, and somebody comes up I'm talking with somebody and a stranger comes up to talk to that person, and if that stranger just talks to the other person and they both ignore me for at least 15 seconds, maybe 20 seconds, then, you know, the person who is the stranger, they just go in the enemy box. They ignore me totally, you know. And anybody who ignores me, something has to be wrong with them. They aren't to be trusted at all. Yeah? Do you sometimes make judgments like that? Yeah, or maybe you even talk to them for a couple of minutes. Yeah, and they said one thing that you didn't like, and then they go in the enemy category. And then we make the enemy category so rigid, you know, that's all that person is. Okay. And this is where we get prejudice and stereotypes. Yeah. And becomes very, very harmful in society. And for our spiritual practice, it's, you know, it's horrible. It just destroys our opportunity to practice because, you know, the mind is just stuck in ignorance, anger, and attachment, which are the three poisonous minds. And we think that that's just being normal and protecting ourselves. Yeah? And when those three are running the show, you know, we're not only going to harm others, but we're putting such a big impediment in front of our own spiritual progress. So it's very worthwhile really checking that a lot, how we discriminate and discern and affix identities onto people. I felt very heartened the other day because, as you know, whenever I try and disassemble identities, people get very mad at me in teachings. And somebody wrote, he lives in Los Angeles, and he was saying how things, you know, people are holding on to such strong identities and there's such animosity in the country. And he, you know, he was saying, boy, you know, we hold on to these identities and then we're miserable and they're so destructive. And I was going finally, somebody understands what I'm trying to say. Yeah. But on the other hand, I wonder if you attended a talk where I was deconstructing his identity, if you would feel that way. Yeah. Now, this person, I think, would understand. But so many of us, you know, again, we point the finger. Those people are attached to their identities. Yeah. But I'm not. Or my group this. Or my group that. Okay. There was, what was it? Yes, an article I read at the New York Times talking about the Democratic elites and how the Democrats were so elitist and how they need to develop more respect for people who aren't as educated. And yes, I think it's very good that we don't get prejudiced and it's only, you know, only people who are educated that we trust and whatever, you know, because everybody has their own skill and interest and each of us contributes in our own way, whether we get paid a lot or paid a little, whether it's high social status or not, everybody is needed. So that was good. But the article only talked about the Democrats considering themselves elitist. Yeah, because they were Ivy League and da-da-da-da-da. And I'm going, what? The Republicans? You don't have any people who are highly educated who are Republicans who are elitist? Why is he just pointing out the Democrats and not also the Republicans, if he's trying to point out the quality of looking down on other people who aren't as educated as you? Because he was saying that many of those people who aren't as educated, they follow Trump, so the Democrats are losing out. But Trump, you know, I mean, talk about elites. He was born into the elite category. But he wasn't selected in here as being somebody who looks down on the people who are less educated. Yeah. So it was quite interesting to me how we always make boxes with people. And of course, the people that we don't like, their identities are especially insidious. Yeah. But the people we like, who we share an identity with, their identities and elitism, whatever it is not so bad. Yeah. And I was also thinking, okay, because you guys know how I apply this to society. So in Portland, there's been the Proud Boys coming and the Patriot Prayer people coming. And then there's been skirmishes in the town and, you know, people getting shot. And I was thinking, yeah, and most of these, the Proud Boys, the Patriot Prayers, all these people, they're white men, okay? Now, when there are skirmishes and guns and things in a minority neighborhood, those groups of men are called gangs. Thugs, yeah. Gangs, they're a member of a gang and they're thugs. When they are white and they carry a gun saying this is my Second Amendment right, then they are members of groups. Yeah, they are not considered thugs. They are not considered gangs. But if I look at the behavior of these people, they're gangs. You know? So instead of being called the Bloods and the Crips, they're called the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayers, but they're looking for skirmishes. you know, and stalking out the streets and claiming their areas on the streets. But it's interesting how they're not being called gangs and thugs. Just a comment, okay? But my point in all this is whether you call them gangs or thugs, or whether you call them people protecting businesses from looters, or people assisting the police, which is what some people call them. You know, no matter what they are called, they are sentient beings under the control of afflictions and karma, and they're worthy of compassion. Yeah, just like, you know, whenever the elite people and the people they look down on, the gangs and the people who they terrorize, which are usually other gangs, or in this case, protesters, whatever we label people, you know, and when you don't know whether to label somebody a protester or a looter, or when those two names get synonymized, so anybody who's a protester becomes a looter, which is not true, yeah, but some people put them together, that no matter what names we attach to sentient beings, they're all sentient beings who want happiness and don't want suffering and are confused about how to create the causes of happiness. Okay, and so that kind of understanding is what we need to come back to. You know, we can look at groups and categories and names and labels and elites and underclassed and oppressors and oppressed. Okay, but everybody boils down to that same thing. And also karmically, one life you're in one category and the next life you're in the opposite category. Okay, and the thing about oppressors and oppressed, yeah, when you look at it, people who are oppressors suffer a lot from arrogance, you know, and misuse the power that they have to oppress other people. In future lives, because of creating that karma, it's very easy for them to be born as people who are oppressed. Okay? So when you look at it this way, who's the oppressor and who's the oppressed? And when people have burned off their karma of being the oppressed, they could be born in a good situation. But then because they have a good situation, yeah, they start oppressing others because of arrogance. So you can go from oppressor to oppressed, from oppressed to oppressor. In samsara, you go back and forth, back and forth, ad infinitum. So who's the real oppressor? Who's the really oppressed? When we look at it from a karmic view. Now, having said this to a group of people who believe in karma, you know what I'm talking about. But I can imagine if some other people listen to this, they're going to be infuriated. Yeah, infuriated. Are you saying that my group, which is oppressed, were actually... they're getting this as a retribution because they were oppressors? No, never. They were never oppressors. Yeah. But in samsara, we go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And anyway, the people who are the oppressors and the oppressed, from one rebirth to another, that changes too. Now, people sometimes ask, and, you know, oh, the Tibetans, you know, they're such kind people, and they were so involved in the Dharma and so on. How come they were oppressed by, you know, the communist Chinese? Shouldn't they have some good karma that would, you know, have led them because for centuries they practiced the Dharma? Wouldn't that have prevented them from being oppressed? But what we're not seeing is the centuries of people practicing the Dharma, those could have been different mind streams than the people who were born at this time when Tibet was occupied and taken over by the communists. So it's not the same, necessarily the same people who created the merit who are now being oppressed. Okay. It could be, because people who create merit also create non-virtue. And people who create non-virtue also create merit. Okay? So whatever way we try and put people in boxes in an effort to understand the world, it fails. Yeah? It doesn't work to do that. We should avoid criticizing other people who we see as bigots or this or that. Or if we criticize them, criticize our own group too. You know, let's be equal. But instead of criticizing with a mind of disparagement and dislike, let's criticize behavior and not sentient beings. Yeah. Okay. So I'm just going to teach from the book today. You can look at the outline yourself and see the different categories. So we're at the beginning of Chapter 3. Chapter 2 was we were purifying and accumulating merit to, you know, prepare our mind to generate bodhicitta and take aspiring bodhicitta and engaging bodhicitta. But if you looked, we did prostrations, offerings, and then confession. The first three of the seven limb prayer in chapter 2. So chapter 3 is starting up with the fourth limb, rejoicing. Okay? So Shanti Deva starts, "Gladly do I rejoice in the virtue that relieves misery of all those in unfortunate states and that gives happiness to the suffering." So these verses, we can sit and do, you know, we can read them quickly or we can sit and really think about them. Okay? So we're rejoicing in the virtue that relieves the misery of all those in the unfortunate states. So all those born as hell beings, animals, hungry ghosts, the virtue that relieves their misery. So this could be the virtue that they created before, when they were human beings, before they took those rebirths. It could also be the virtue that people in the human realm now create by trying to assist those beings. So for example, with animals, we do try and relieve animals of their misery. At least some people do. Some people, you know, being an animal is not fun. Yeah, when you're used for hard labor by sentient beings and then disposed of when you're old, or, you know, when it's taken for granted that you're okay, giving up your body so somebody can eat lunch. Animals are abused that way. We don't create virtue with them. But there's many ways in which we can. And, feeding them, protecting them from suffering, and making it so that they can hear the Dharma. So we try and walk our kitties around the stupa, in the garden. Now we're having teachings in this building. Usually we have them in the building where the kitties are. That way they can hear the teachings. But it's very good for the animals to hear teachings. Many people send us pictures of their cats and dogs sitting at the computer with them, listening to teachings. It's very cute. And then, rejoicing at all the virtue, all the actions people do, that gives happiness to the suffering. So even people who are working, in socially engaged projects that benefit people even in the human realm. I was reading that 1 in 8 families in the U.S., so more than 10% of U.S. families, don't have enough to eat and are really scrimping now in order to put food on the table. That's totally outrageous. But anything we can do to give to the food banks, to give to the various charities that distribute food, then that's really something quite wonderful. Mm-hmm. So if you don't need your $1,200 check from Uncle Sam, contemplate giving it away to some charities or to a family you know that needs it. Okay, in verse 2, I rejoice in that gathering of virtue that is the cause for Arhat's awakening. I rejoice in the definite freedom of embodied beings from the misery of cyclic existence. Okay, so Arhats are those who are now free of the misery of cyclic existence because of their profound practice. And so here too, rejoicing in all the virtues they created to be able to free themselves from samsara. Yeah, so the virtues they created from, purification, from meditating on emptiness, from living in communities and teaching the Dharma and leading the public in Dharma activities. So we rejoice at all that virtue. And then 3, I rejoice in the awakening of the Buddhas and also the spiritual levels of their children. Whenever it talks about the Buddha's children, it's referring to bodhisattvas. Okay, so, and Buddha's children don't whine. Okay, so here we're rejoicing at all the virtues of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, which if you really think about it, it's immense. And, if you read the Sutra of the Ten Grounds, and in each ground, they're talking about the practices of those bodhisattvas. And it's just incredible how they practice. I mean, just you read it and you go, oh my goodness, I never even thought of that before. And here are these beings who are actually doing it. Okay, so it makes the mind quite happy and we can really rejoice. If you're looking for that sutra, I don't know if the 84,000 that project has translated it yet. I haven't looked on their website. But there is a translation from the Chinese, and we have a copy of that in our library. Okay. It's done by a monk named Dharma Mitra. Okay, he lives in West Seattle. Yeah, beautiful translation. Okay, verse 4. And with gladness I rejoice in the ocean of virtue for developing an awakening mind, for developing bodhicitta, that wishes all beings to be happy, as well as in the deeds that bring them benefits. So even ordinary beings, okay, who are trying to create virtue so that they can develop bodhicitta, we rejoice in all of their merit also, you know. And any thought that any sentient being has to take care of others and to alleviate them from misery and bring them happiness. So to really rejoice at that. And here, you know, when they talk about the frontline workers during the pandemic, these are the people who really we can rejoice a lot about, you know? And it really kind of blows my mind how many of these people, at their own personal risk, because many of them have died from COVID-19, stay and help in hospitals and do this. So to rejoice in their merit. Yeah. And it would be nice if society paid many of these healthcare workers a living wage and a decent wage, not just the doctors, but everybody else. Nurses too, right? Okay. So those four are talking about the branch of rejoicing. The fifth verse is requesting teachings. Okay. The fifth of the, it's interesting, the fifth of the seven limbs is in the fifth verse here. With folded hands, I beseech the Buddhas of all directions to shine the lamp of Dharma for all bewildered in misery's gloom. Okay, so asking the Buddhas to appear in any kind of form where that would communicate with, you know, the whole diversity of sentient beings, and to teach those sentient beings according to those sentient beings' dispositions and interest. Okay? So this is why it's very good that we have different kinds of teachers and different Buddhist traditions, because, you know, if everybody is teaching with integrity and relying on the Buddha's word, since the Buddha taught in different ways for sentient beings, then these teachers can do that too. And it really helps such a diversity of beings connect with the Dharma. Okay? So some people, you know, what gets them interested in the Dharma is the study side, you know, using reasoning and studying texts. Other people, what gets them interested in the Dharma is meditation, and they want to do that. Other people get interested in the Dharma because they hear about benefiting others and they really want to do that in society and reach out. And among them, some people want to do climate change work, and some people want to do, things for immigrants and so on. So there's many ways that people get interested in the Dharma. So if you have a variety of teachers who are sensitive to the different needs of sentient beings and can teach accordingly, then, you know, that is really something quite precious. So it says that only the Buddhas really know all the sentient beings' karma and what is going to be best for them. Yeah, the rest of us are basically shooting in the dark, as they say, and, hoping that it helps somebody. Yeah, because we don't know people's interests and so on. But, you know, you have the motivation to do that. Okay. And so here we're asking the Buddhas to specifically to teach us and to teach everybody in the world, yeah, according to all the sentient beings' different dispositions. And there's a lot of different dispositions. Yeah, a whole lot of them. Yeah, sometimes people think that when you're in a group of Buddhists, or especially you're in a group of Buddhist monastics, that, you know, everybody wears the same clothes and the same hair, and so you all have cookie-cutter personalities. Wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong. You have incredible divergent personalities, different ways of seeing things, different needs, different dispositions. Okay. So you have to find a way. The Buddhas, you know, that's why they manifest in different forms. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then verse 6 is the sixth limb of the seven limb prayer, which is requesting all the Buddhas not to pass into parinirvana, but to remain in our world and to continue to be present. And this is so important. This and the previous one of requesting teachings are so important because we really tend to take the Dharma for granted, and that it's always going to be here, and the teachers are always going to be here. And when we get around to it, and when it's convenient in our schedule, then we'll go. Okay? But it doesn't really work like that. Yeah. When I was sent as a baby nun to Italy, the Dharma Center there did not have a resident teacher. And I had been used to living in a monastery with my teachers and receiving regular teachings and guidance. And then all of a sudden, instead of them being there, it was macho Italian monks. And I started doing these two verses a lot, with a lot of intensity in my mind, because I really saw how important it is to have teachings and how dependent I am on my teachers for the teachings. And for the teachers to be able to teach, how important it is for the Buddhas to manifest in the world and not just go into parinirvana and say, you know, kind of, you guys are hopeless. Yeah. So there's a story of Shakyamuni Buddha. I don't know where it's from or how true it is, but apparently they were having a convention of all the Buddhas, you know, probably in somebody's Pure Land at some White House in the Pure Land, but it was a non-denominational White House that wasn't using it for the sake of a particular party. So they were having a convention there, and the Buddha in charge looked at all the other Buddhas and said, who is going to help all the sentient beings in the Saha world? So we're part of the Saha world. Saha world means the suffering, confused world. Who's going to help all those sentient beings? So as the story goes, and I don't think it's really accurate, a lot of Buddhas went, or sorry, I have to leave. My disciples are calling me. But Shakyamuni Buddha stood up and said, I will teach the beings in the Saha world. And so that's how he wound up manifesting as Shakyamuni Buddha, you know, and being with us. Yeah. Now, do you think it's fun for a Buddha to guide disciples like us? Yeah. I mean, compare us to the beings in the Pure Lands, the Arya Bodhisattvas in the Pure Lands, that the Sambhogakaya or enjoyment bodies of the Buddhas that they teach. Yeah, those Arya beings have realized emptiness. They have no interest in cyclic existence. They just want to practice. Yeah, and become Buddhas. Boy, teaching those disciples must be a breeze. And then you come to our world, the Saha world, you know, and it's like herding cats to get everybody to come to a teaching, because this one has to go to a wedding and that one is working overtime and the other one, their little toe hurts, and this one, their cat is sick, and, you know, and they all have reasons why they can't get to teachings or reasons why they can't practice. Yeah. And here are the Buddhas, you know, trying to teach the Dharma and everything. But, you know, we get distracted during the teachings, or we get up because we have to go pee-pee and we don't come back because, you know, the teacher wasn't humorous enough. So we were getting bored, or because we're a little bit snotty and we heard those teachings before, so who wants to hear them again? You know, and then the Buddhas are stuck with people like us as disciples. Yeah. And they teach us and then we go do the opposite. Yeah. My teacher said, we're like puppies that you clean them and then they go roll in the mud. And that's, you know, what we're like compared to the Arya Bodhisattvas. So, Shakyamuni Buddha really, I mean, he bit off something quite difficult to chew. But, you know, we really, when you have a sincere spiritual yearning, and then there's no teachers around, or all the teachers are Charlatananda incarnate, yeah, then you really go, oh my goodness, you know, it's important to have reliable teachers. And it's important that the Buddha manifest and doesn't disappear. Because if there's no form bodies in the world, then, you know, how are we going to get help? Then people say, but if the Buddha manifests in all these ways in our world, how come we don't know them? Yeah. Why don't they do magical tricks and miracles? And then we would recognize who's a Buddha and who isn't, and we would have faith. Yeah. Well, first of all, to do miraculous, you know, miracle things, you don't need to be a Buddha to do that. If you have deep concentration, you can do some of these inexplicable things to ordinary people. But also, if the Buddhas just went around doing that, then everybody would stare at them and go, oh, wow, look what they did, and think that that was indicative of somebody with spiritual realizations. But you can do all those kinds of things and be quite arrogant, actually, and you know, that doesn't really benefit sentient beings. And for sentient beings to get all excited about somebody who made a rabbit appear out of their hands or, you know, did something like that, then, and for them to think that is indicative of Dharma realizations, then if you try and teach those people to have good ethical conduct, they're going to say, how's that going to help me pull a rabbit out of the hat? You know, and they're just going to sit there and worship those figures that do instead of actually try and change their minds and become kinder people. Okay, so verse 6, with folded hands, I beseech the conquerors who wish to pass away to please remain for countless eons and not to leave the world in darkness. Yeah. So these verses really require us sitting and meditating and imagining yeah, either the things to rejoice, or imagining not having a teacher, or imagining being born in a world where the Buddha hasn't appeared, and where there's no Dharma to follow, and really contemplating these. And then it makes it so that when we do the seven in prayer and make these requests, they become quite heartfelt. Mm-hmm. Then verse 7 is the dedication verse in the seven in prayer. Thus, by this virtue collected, through all that I have done, may the pain of every living creature be completely cleared away. Yeah. How often do we have that thought? Yeah. May the pain of every living creature be completely cleared away. Huh? How often do sentient beings on this planet have that thought? You might say, well, at Christmas time, they think that. But they think it only for their relatives and friends. Yeah. So, you know, just thinking about that idea of being in tune with the pains, mental and physical, of every living being, and dedicating the results of our energies so that they can be alleviated from suffering, that's something quite amazing. Yeah, because what do we usually wish for? Yeah. Yeah. What most of our aspirations, you know, what do they wish for? I hope we have a good lunch. Yeah? In the morning? Oh, I hope we have a good lunch. Yeah. I hope my car doesn't break down. I hope I can get a job. Yeah. I hope somebody gets into college. Yeah. But in terms of really wishing, aspiring for something big like this, it's not common. So that's why it's really quite important to think big when we not only dedicate at the end of our virtuous activities, but at the beginning when we generate our motivation, to really have a very big mind and be very inclusive. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then there's more aspirations that follow. So these are also ways to dedicate the merit by making these kinds of aspirations. So may I be the doctor, the medicine, and may I be the nurse for all sick beings in the world until everyone is healed. So of course, in a medical situation, can I be the doctor, the nurse, the medicine? But that analogy is often used for how the Buddha, how the three jewels help sentient beings. The Buddha is like the doctor, the Dharma is the medicine, and the Sangha is like the nurse. So may I help sentient beings both physically and spiritually in this way. Okay. And so, you know, these verses here where we're really making dedications for the welfare of living beings, you can also bring this in when you do the taking and giving meditation, okay? So that you can think of becoming all these different things according to what sentient beings need, and then sending out your body, manifesting many different forms, to become what sentient beings need. Mm. So you make it much more detailed when you do Tonglen instead of, I take all the suffering, I give my happiness, but everything's very, it's not detailed, so then it's very easy, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, all their suffering I take, I give them all my happiness, but actually we're not feeling any of that. We're not really willing to take on anybody's suffering or willing to give them our happiness. But we feel good, you know, just breathing in and out, thinking that. So these verses make it much more personal, you know, and detailed about the kinds of ways in which we want to give sentient beings happiness and the different ways in which they are suffering that we should think of taking on or obliterating. Okay, in verse 9, may a rain of food and drink descend to clear away the pain of thirst and hunger. And during the eon of famine, may I change myself into food and drink. Yeah. So may all the Red Cross and Red Crescent and NGO food trucks make it into areas where people are starving without being intercepted by armies and the goods stolen from them, but may they reach the people who are really hungry and in need. You know, so start with something really in our world. And may all the food banks and NGOs in all the countries where there's the coronavirus, may they have enough, and may all of this be given out to the sentient beings, and may they have a wide variety of nutritious food so that everybody can get what they like and not just junk food. Okay. Okay, so really thinking about this and wishing for it in our world, and then in a very abstract way for all the living beings too. And living beings under the sea who can't get food because of climate change and pollution in their areas, beings on the land, in the air, who need food and have trouble getting it, let alone all the hungry ghosts. Okay, and then may my own body change into food and drink and be what others need. So we've all seen that picture of the child starving in, I forget if it was Darfur, someplace in Africa, with the vulture sitting next to him. Yeah, we've seen that picture. So imagine changing your body into food that that child can eat and into food that the vulture can eat, so that the vulture isn't waiting for the child to die to eat the child. But instead, we give our body and we satisfy the hunger and thirst of both. And 10, may I become an inexhaustible treasure for those who are poor and destitute. May I turn into all things they could need and be placed close beside them. Okay, so all the poor and destitute, may we become what they need. If they need houses, if they need shelter, if they need protection or foods or medicine or translators or friendly border guards or maybe no border guards or lawyers or, whatever people need, transport, can we become those things so that they have them? And when we become those, may we be next to them so that they don't have to search all over the place to find us. Okay. So also here, we think of the poor and destitute, those people who are poor and destitute materially. I mean, their hunger and thirst and danger and illness and fear is very easy to understand. But what about those who are poor and destitute spiritually? What about the people who think they have everything under control, or can get everything under control because they're wealthy? Aren't they poor and destitute too? Yeah? They're spiritually impoverished, spiritually destitute. Yeah. So can we become an inexhaustible treasure to those people, maybe teaching them virtuous conduct, yeah, teaching them generosity, depending on the person, whatever we can teach them, that would help them so that they weren't so miserable and locked into themselves. Mm-hmm. Okay. Or people with mental illnesses, they are poor and destitute in another way. Yeah, or people who are bullied. Yeah, kids on the playground that other kids make fun of or tease or bully. You know, may we become an inexhaustible treasure for those people, which may be just one person who sticks up for them and one person who takes interest in them. Very often with kids like that, all it takes is one adult that really is interested and cares for them. Yeah. So can we become that person? Okay. Then verse 11, without any sense of loss, I shall give up my body and enjoyments, as well as all my virtues of the three times for the sake of benefiting all. So again, practice of generosity, and dedicating merit is a practice of generosity. This reminds us of the inner offering where we say without any sense of loss, I give up my body and enjoyments. Yeah, remember the inner offering? We recited enough. So it's similar in that way. So without any sense of loss, that means that when we give, we really give so that it is no longer ours and it belongs to the other person. And then the other person is totally free to do what they want with it. So when we give, there's no strings attached, okay? So there's different kinds of strings. Sometimes we give something and we feel the loss of, oh, I just gave that blanket away. What happens if I need it? Oh, I just gave that canteen away. What happens if I need it? Oh, I just gave some money away. What happens if I need it? So there's a sense of loss, okay? So here, really freeing us from that and thinking, I just give it. It's no, you know, and I'm not worried about myself, yeah, not having it. I just give it, okay? So whether it's your plastic-covered paper clips that you are sure you're going to suffer if you give them to somebody else, you know, or whether it's $1 million, the fear of loss can be the same the way our mind works, because our mind can get stingy and attached to anything, yeah, depending on the situation. Okay, so without any sense of loss, without any sense of expectation. So I gave you something. Now I'm expecting you to feel grateful to me. Now I'm expecting you to praise me or at least tell other people how generous I was. Or now I expect you to love me. I gave you a present. Yeah. You should reciprocate by loving me. Okay? And if the person doesn't love us back after we gave them the present, we feel a sense of loss. Or if the person doesn't even say thank you, yeah, then we sometimes get mad. Okay? So without that those kinds of strings, yeah, without expecting them to speak well of us or speak well to us or love us or like us or do something for us. Yeah, just giving because we want them to have that. It's quite a practice when you think about it. Yeah, it's quite a practice. So I remember one time at the Abbey, we should probably do this again too, but we had the assignment to give something that you're attached to. Do you remember that? And we all brought something that we're attached to that was ours, you know, not something in the kitchen we're attached to that belongs to the community, but something that is ours that we're attached to. And we brought it, and then everybody got to pick something that somebody else was attached to take home with them. And it wasn't just a small attachment. It was something that you really were attached to. It wasn't something that you wanted to get rid of and you were pretending to be generous by giving it away. It was something that was very important to you. Yeah. And then we put it together, and then everybody chose how to do it, you know, chose something from it. And then we all looked at our own minds and our thoughts about, you know, what was it? Now somebody has my water bowls. What was it? Red. Ruby red glass water bowls, and now somebody else has them. Yeah. Mine, what I gave was a picture I really loved of His Holiness. Yeah. It's somewhere in the Abbey. I don't know where. What's amazing, because at the beginning, when you gave it up and somebody took it, it was like, oh, I don't have it anymore. But how often do you think about your ruby red glass?
I finally have given them up completely.
Yeah.
It took some years.
Yeah. But it's like we don't, the picture I gave of His Holiness, I don't think about that picture every day. And I didn't, you know, from the time I gave it away, it was like, oh, I'm going to miss seeing that picture every day. But then I didn't miss seeing it every day. It wasn't around to miss. Yeah. So it's interesting how, sometimes we can't give something up. And then later we do, and it's like we don't even think about it anymore. But it was so painful to give it away. So we have so many trips about generosity. Yeah, so many things that impede our generosity. And we also have problems accepting things from other people, too. It's not just giving, it's accepting. And to understand that accepting somebody else's generosity is, if we do it in the correct way, that is also a way of generosity, a practice of generosity, because we are giving somebody else the opportunity to accrue merit. So I'm not talking about, you know, oh, goody, somebody's giving me something, yippee. I'm not talking about that. But overcoming all the different mental things we have that inhibit us from accepting somebody else's kindness. Why, when people point out something we did well, some people usually say, it wasn't really me, or it's, no, I didn't do it, or I don't deserve that, or it also has many faults, you didn't notice it. It's when somebody compliments us and we dismiss the compliment thinking that we're being humble, or because we feel inadequate and we feel undeserving of a compliment and we can't even take it in and let it in our awareness that somebody could be complimenting us for something we did well. So we immediately push it away or trivialize it. When we do that in front of a person who's given us something, it's like saying, you're really stupid for giving me something. It diminishes, it's ignoring their generosity. And it can be very hurtful to somebody else. We don't recognize that it could be hurtful to somebody else. We may think, you know, we're humble, or we may just be caught up in our own undeserving trip. But it's painful to somebody else. They're giving us a gift, and we're not even saying thank you. Yeah. Or somebody gives us a physical gift, and the first thing we say is, oh, you shouldn't have done this. Or, you know, oh, I hope you didn't spend too much money. Or, you know, or immediately our mind goes to, what kind of gift did I give them before? Was it costly, like what they're giving me? Or, oh, no, they're giving me something that costs more than what I gave them as before. So that means next time I give them a gift, I have to buy a more expensive one. That makes me feel really obligated. Huh? Anybody think like that? Yeah. Or, somebody gave me a gift. Now I have to do them a favor. Now I have to praise them. Now I have to act like I am so thankful, you know, even though I really don't feel it. You know, and so we have so many ways of, you know, somebody gave me a gift, I don't deserve it, of blocking somebody's generosity instead of just saying thank you. Yeah, and saying thank you from the heart. And that's it. Yeah, or, you know, often, I mean, when I give gifts to my teachers, they never say thank you. Yeah. And in fact, often they turn around and give it away. And it's a wonderful practice to see that. Yeah. I think I've told you the story of how I handmade brocade book covers for Lama Zopa one summer, hand-stitched them. Beautiful brocade, went in, offered them to Rinpoche. Yeah, you know, put them down. He didn't say anything. Anyway, that's okay, because I know he's not going to say anything. I left, and then Geshe Jampa Wangdu was the next one who came in to visit Rinpoche. And I saw when he left, he was carrying the book covers I had given to Rinpoche. So Rinpoche owned them for a half an hour and, you know, at max, and then gave them away. And you know, and that's good. I mean, I actually, when people, like when we're in Singapore, people bring so much stuff. And I really appreciate their generosity, not because I, you know, eat all the stuff or use all the stuff, but it gives me things to give to other people who come to visit. Yeah. And so, you know, that's something that I also see with some of my teachers. You go to visit them and you leave with something, you know, maybe it's this big or whatever. Sometimes you don't leave with anything. Sometimes you leave with something. It doesn't really matter. Okay. But the things people bring, then when I offer on my altar, I offer the whole package. Yeah. Because there's so many packages. I know every day I'm there, I can have a whole package to put on the altar. I don't have to just take part of it and make one package last for a long time. So it's really nice to do that. Yeah. And then after I offer it to the Buddha, then somebody comes to visit, we give it to them, okay? Or we bring it back here. So, you know, and all of you munch. but, you know, it's just you know, to really see how much delight people take in being generous, and then how to just accept it and pass it on without clinging, without feeling obligated, without feeling arrogant, without feeling like you're undeserving, you know, without all of that kind of afflicted stuff that gets in the way. So to be able to give and receive in that way. Yeah. So we have a few minutes for questions.
Related to the picture of the child and the vulture, I always think about the photographer too. I think he who won the Pulitzer for it and then killed himself.
And killed himself?
He killed himself, I believe so. Just the grief of witnessing that, being helpless, and then winning a prize for the picture. I think, if, I'm not sure if that was, I recall that was a story that, around the picture.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Last time you gave us the homework of thinking about the conceit of I am.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's rather overwhelming. And I'm just concluding now that with an ordinary mind, that absolutely every thought is actually, you know, you're imposing something on someone with an ordinary mind.
Mm.
So do you have any advice on how to deal with this suffering state until the path of seeing?
Yeah. I think, you know, just to completely, you know, just periodically just check, am I my body, am I my mind, who am I, you know, where is this I that I'm putting forth so much, what in the world is it anyway, and what in the world do I think I'm going to get by putting it out forth? What am I going to get that is of any lasting value?
So when we're giving something away that we're very attached to, maybe we see that over time that sense of loss evaporates. But the next time we give something away, that sense of loss comes up again. What can we do to work with that to mitigate that sense of loss other than time?
Okay. Give it. Give the thing. When you have the sense of loss, you aren't giving it. Yeah? We aren't giving it. So we have to, like, really give it, you know? It doesn't belong to me, you know? As if we never had it, as if it were always the other person's possession, you know? Because if it's something that belongs to somebody else, you know, you may have a really nice jacket, but and I may say, well, that's a nice jacket, but I'm not going to feel a sense of loss because you have it. I might feel jealous because I want it, but I'm not going to feel a sense of loss. So, you know, that thing of, okay, it doesn't belong to me. And along that line, what's very helpful is when you do the mandala offering, put the specific things that you're attached to, including people you're attached to, in the mandala offering and offer them to the Buddha. And then you think, they don't belong to me to start with. You know, so how can I even give this away? It actually belongs to the Buddha. So then as well, the Buddha kind of is loaning it to me so I can create some merit by generosity, but I already gave it to the Buddha. So it's not mine. Mm-hmm. Or to think everything we have actually belongs to somebody else. Because when we came into this life, you know, we didn't have anything. So everything we have now was given to us by somebody else. You know, and so don't think, well, I earned it because I worked so hard. Yeah. That was nice, you worked hard, great, but, you know, that doesn't make your paycheck inherently yours. So think, you know, it actually belonged to somebody else and they're giving it to me.
Two questions online. One is, how do you handle someone who, when you do things for charity, they keep saying, I hope they appreciate you. I hope they know they owe you and you are getting no, and then you get nowhere explaining to them that's not how it works.
Change the topic. I mean, people are always asking me these questions. I try and explain this, that, and the other to somebody, but they don't want to hear it. So they're asking me, how do I make them hear something they don't want to hear? How am I supposed to know the answer to that? You know, I'm not a wizard. Yeah. And so, you know, if somebody is not receptive to what you're saying, change the topic. Talk about something else.
The second question is...
Sorry, whoever asked the question, don't feel offended, but it's true, isn't it? Yeah? If you don't know how to get through to them, how am I supposed to know? Yeah, I mean, talk, you know, you can use NVC and reflective listening and all of those kinds of things, but that's something you have to learn and practice, and I can't give you a quick, easy answer to it.
I gave a person a gift and she became so angry with me and I felt so bad. How do I manage this kind of thing and not feel so bad?
Oh, really, you should surprised. Have said, fantastic. I'm so glad that she threw it back in my face. Yeah, because now I can see that I wasn't really giving it, that I had expectations of thanks and accolades and love and appreciation. And this person is helping my Dharma practice because they're showing me that I wasn't really being generous. I was bargaining. It's true, isn't it? If you ask that question to Lama Zopa, that's exactly what he would say. Oh, good, fantastic. And if you're a Dharma practitioner, that's how you react to adversity. You say, this is so good because now I have a chance to practice. Now my negative karma is burning up. Now I'm being able to see my afflictions and my lack of honesty and sincerity. Yeah, and that gives me the chance to improve and to practice better. So this person is helping me.
What happens when it's the other way around? If the other person thinks that you belong to him or her, how do you handle that situation?
You make it very clear that you're not a possession. Yeah. I mean, if you make commitments, if you take marital vows, somebody does say, you're my husband, you're my wife. Yeah. Or you're my child. So there are those conventional things. Yeah, but when you say somebody possesses you, what does that really mean? That they're trying to control you? That they're limiting your contact with other people because they're afraid that you're going to run away? If you're in that kind of situation, yeah, sometimes that happens to women in very abusive relationships. The man won't let them out of the house, won't let them have friends, won't let them do other things, because very, very possessive. In that kind of situation, you definitely need to leave. But if it's just a regular situation where you feel, yeah, kind of commonly accepted possessiveness on the part of the other person, which you're not accepting, and which many other people wouldn't, but it's not something to the level of abuse, then, you know, again, you're asking a personal question. You have an idea of a specific situation. I don't have any idea of that situation you're talking about. You know, I don't know if it's between a couple or if it's with an employer or a parent or, you know, your cat. Or your dog who won't, you know, always have to be with there. They think they own you and they can dictate to you, you know. So it's these personal questions. They're asked as general ones, but if I give an answer, the person is listening from the perspective of their specific, specific situation to an answer that I'm giving in a general way. And they could get entirely the wrong advice that's not really suited for their situation. So please excuse me if I don't answer that. So now that all of the people who have asked questions feel discontent and dissatisfied.
I was just wondering about the thing with the conceit of I am, according to Chandrakirti down on our entryway, mm-hmm. the very next thing is then mine or attached to things. So it seems like with the practice of generosity, of actually being able to give, you'd have to be have realizations almost not to have mine come up.
Mm.
My and mine follow the I, the sense of I, yeah. just like naturally.
Yeah. Well, what this
these
is...
Other, so what I'm, my yeah. question is really, it seems to me that then like these other techniques that we're using, which are very beneficial, are just temporary
mm-hmm.
at best.
Yeah. But that's how... we always deal with our afflictions. Realizing emptiness is very difficult. Yeah, so we can't, as new people, we can't count on that to solve all of our afflictions. So that's why the Buddha taught all these other methods that are affliction specific. You know, like impermanence for attachment and rejoicing for jealousy, because those methods are much easier to practice. They don't solve the problem completely, but they enable us to not create horrendous virtuous karma and to pacify whatever affliction is in our mind. But as they always say, it's only the direct realization of emptiness that can cut it from our mind completely. So, you know, that's why we have to realize all these things that we practice, you know, we can easily see what the ideal way to do them is, but we aren't there. So don't sit there and beat yourself up because you aren't there and feel like you're insufficient. Practice the other techniques that you can master, that you can make work for you, and those already take a lot of energy and effort. Practice those, and so learn to become a doctor to your mind right now and keep your mind balanced and smooth out the bumps. Yeah? Don't expect yourself to... Yes, totally unrealistic to think, oh, well, now I notice I have the conceit of I. So now that I've noticed it, and I know that the I is empty of inherent existence, so that should deal with the problem.
I'm thinking about my own mind, but I'm also recalling, as you say this, a friend of ours
mm-hmm.
who came here once, hoping to make this offering of service to the Abbey, and came here with a very sincere mind of wanting to just be generous.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if it's okay, if you're here for an hour, you might be able to pull it off. But if you're here for a month or two, you can't actually pull it off. And how disappointed this person was, because mm-hmm. they came here with this really good heart, wanting to do this thing, and they couldn't pull it off
mm-hmm.
because of unrealistic expectations. I can yeah. see that in myself. I can see it in that situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have to ask the question, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, whenever we give, we're always seeing whether we volunteer to do something or whatever, to check, and, you know, what is the mind expecting? Yeah, what am I expecting from this? And even when we have friends, what am I expecting from friends? Yeah, and even if it is a common expectation that's reasonable, give space to know that the other person may mess up and they may not do that. Yeah. And especially, like you say, you know, people come in and I want to serve and kind of like, everything I do is going to make a really big difference and these people are going to be so happy I'm here. And they're really happy that you're here, but they don't always fuss about you and say thank you over every small thing that you did and point out to others how wonderful they are. You know, you just join the crowd and you do what you do and nobody's going to make a big deal out of you. Yeah. And that's actually good for our practice because if we're, you know, people were always making a big deal out of us, then they're going to be encouraging our afflictions and they're not helping us to practice. Yeah, but it's something. I mean, we often do that. Somebody's sick and, you know, so we bake one casserole after another for them and expect them, you know, to be overjoyed and hug us and kiss us because we're baking casseroles. But, you know, it joins the other 50 casseroles that other people are bringing. Yeah, I remember one of my friends when he, you know, his wife died and he said, you know, I appreciate these casseroles, but I can't eat them all. And it's like, stop bringing me casseroles. But people bring casseroles for the first week and after that they forget about you and they expect you to not be grieving and not need anything to eat anymore. So, yeah. 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 So save your casseroles. After a week, you'll need them. Okay.